Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Prior to the confirmation hearing of John Brennan, President Obama's nominee to head the CIA, media headlines promised tough questioning by the Senate Intelligence Committee. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution's headline, CIA nominee Brennan faces tough questions. PBS NewsHour, Brennan to face tough questions on drones memo. USA Today, tough questions for CIA nominee Brennan. You get the idea. So did it happen? Was John Brennan questioned about his role in the U.S. drone policy, the program that transfers detainees from one country to another to be interrogated, and torture? What role have the media played in declassifying President Obama's drone program? Joining us to discuss coverage is Mark Siebel. He oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondence. Mark Siebel. He joined the Bureau in 2003 as the editor in charge of international and national security coverage. He was assigned to Knight Ridder's Washington Bureau to coordinate reporters during both the Gulf War in 1991 and the March 2003 invasion of Iraq. And Mark joins us from Washington. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
We are also joined by Silvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for NPR's Foreign Desk, where she covers political, economic, and cultural news in Italy, the Vatican, Western Europe, and the Balkans. She's been covering the economic crisis in Europe, and her latest pieces focus on the privatization of Greek assets and the effects of 3 years on austerity in Greece. She reports that with further cutbacks and tight tax hikes about to kick in, Greece's social fabric is being torn apart. Nowhere are cutbacks more visible and painful than in healthcare. Universal coverage, which most countries in Western Europe have in some form, is no more in Greece. Now, a year after losing a job, a worker loses all benefits. And Silvia Poggioli joins us from Rome. Hi, Silvia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we like to start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Mark, why don't we start off with you? Where did you see good reporting this week?
Well, there was a lot of good reporting this week, but the piece that I particularly thought was interesting and provocative is a blog post by Mark Lynch at foreignpolicy.com that discussed the controversy over whether the United States should be giving military aid to the Syrian rebels. It's obviously a provocative piece. It came up yesterday in the Benghazi hearing that the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, and the Joint Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, testified at. And it was in sort of a surprising way they acknowledged that they had agreed with Hillary Clinton and with David Petraeus that we ought to be giving military aid to the rebels. Mark Lynch has argued against that, and his blog post today continues that argument. He was fairly roundly criticized for it, but he discusses really the six reasons or the six factors that ought to be considered before military aid is given to the rebels. The biggest factor being, would it make a difference? And he argues that there's reason to believe that it wouldn't make a difference, and that in any case, ousting Assad was never going to be easy, and that what might happen is that you shift power to the men with guns more so than has already happened. So it's a very interesting discussion of the piece. He's acknowledging that conditions are changing there on the ground, but I think he raises lots of issues that thoughtful people ought to consider as we look at the mayhem that's Syria today.
Mm. How is McClatchy covering this?
Well, we have a reporter, correspondent by the name of David Enders, who basically is devoted full-time to Syria for us. He's one of the few reporters who spends most of his time inside Syria. He was the first reporter to really outline how the rebels had been able to set up a fairly safe zone in north-central Syria. And he was also the first reporter to really point out how Jabhat al-Nusra, or the Nusra Front, which the State Department now tells us is an al-Qaeda in Iraq affiliate, how they were leading most of the rebel victories towards the end of last year.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Mark. And we'll find that piece and put it on our website right after the show. What about you, Sylvia? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, a piece I really found fascinating because it opened up a whole area that I knew nothing about was a piece by Andrew Higgins in the New York Times about Europe's plan for a global positioning system to rival the United States system. It's called the Galileo, or the European Global Navigation Satellite System. And it turns out its headquarters are here in Italy, not very far from Rome. But what's fascinating, it's way over budget, sometimes something like three times over budget, years behind schedule. And yet, it's one of the a few programs in this, given the Eurozone crisis of the last few years, which where all these, especially the North European countries, have been so obsessed with austerity, budget cutting, and everything, it seems that everybody is very much in favor of it. And according to Higgins, who's writing, he says it's perhaps the one thing that still seems to overcome European leaders' devotion to austerity, because it means economic and technological independence from the United States. Hmm. Now, it so happens that today in Brussels, I believe in Brussels, the European leaders were finally getting down to trying to agree to a budget for the next 7 years. It's been in the works for several. They have failed up to now, and the news is that they did agree. It's a smaller budget than usual. It's $1.28 trillion for the next 7 years. It's not clear to me yet whether the Galileo is going to be included or not, but it would seem maybe that this is one thing that will survive the budget cutting.
And so regardless of this decision, what do you see coming? Because we're going to talk to you about your latest piece, For Greeks, Painful Cuts Keep Tearing at the Social Fabric. Does everyone just expect more cuts in the future?
Well, according to the laws already passed by the Greek parliament, there are more cuts are coming into effect in the next few months. These were measures that were basically dictated to Greece by the so-called Troika. That's the three major international lenders those who have given Greece the bailout: the European Union Commission, the European Central Bank, and the IMF. And they have been basically telling the Greek government, you know, what has to be done, and more cuts are coming, and it's getting harder and harder. At the same time, we see a lot of reports coming out of sort of the economic media or out of maybe outside other northern capitals of Europe saying things are getting better, the situation is better. I was just there for 2 weeks, and I've never seen it quite so bad, and I've been covering this story now for about 3 years. And it may be ultimately that things are beginning to kick in at the macroeconomic level, that, you know, maybe the bank level, some money is beginning to circulate. But down on the ground, Greeks are really, really hurting. There was a survey that just came out today that 90% of households have had a 38% income drop. And this has other repercussions also for the government, because the government has been planning on certain revenues coming in. For people paying their, they can't pay their bills anymore. And so this means also it's going to send, you know, it's going to put a spanner in the whole works of what their you know, their forecasts are, also of what their tax revenues are going to be.
Well, I didn't realize that the cutbacks in Greece have been the most drastic so far. And also, you report that universal health coverage, which most countries in Western Europe have in some form, is no more in Greece. After a year of losing a job, workers lose all of their benefits. So how are they coping? Give us a couple of, share some stories based on what you heard on the ground.
Well, already a year ago, I went to a small port town near Piraeus, where the unemployment a year ago was already 95%. Wow. So you can imagine. And there I found the NGO Doctors of the World, Médecins du Monde, had given up, had decided not to do a certain project that they were planning to do in Somalia, if I remember it was Somalia, and decided to put all their funds into opening up a clinic in this small town called Perema near Piraeus. And it was basically the only source of health care for this entire population of people who had been left unemployed. This time I went to another one of these volunteer clinics that was set up by a group of doctors. They've set it up in what was the an abandoned, what was the former airport site. The local mayor gave them the building there. And there you find doctors who are, and they're offering every care possible from dental to cancer, and their medicines are being donated by pharmacies or by other patients who don't need them anymore. And while I was there, there were several people in line, very well-dressed, middle-class people that you don't see. These are not homeless types, or these are normal people. And waiting in line, to one woman was waiting for her medicines for her breast cancer. There are millions of, thousands of these very, very sad stories. Soup kitchens are all over the place. The lines are getting longer and longer. And it's really very sad. One custom has developed there now that the slightly better off, I've seen this in Athens quite a few times, the better off people leave packages, very nicely packaged, discreetly packaged leftovers next to trash bins, not wow. in them, so that people will be spared the humiliation of scavenging in trash bins, which you see a lot of now in Athens.
You also report the woman that you mentioned that has cancer. She's got three grown children. They all have degrees. They speak several languages, and they've all lost their jobs.
Yep.
And so, right. So this is a common story. So is this getting much coverage across Europe? Just looking at how these cuts are affecting people on the ground.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I'm based here in Italy, and I was also just a few weeks in Spain. And what you see, if there's crisis, the crisis in Spain is very, very serious, not quite as bad as Greece, but it's very serious. Here in Italy, it's getting bad, but it's the least bad of the three countries. Also in Portugal, it's very, very bad. And what is interesting is that the Greek situation, which is the worst of all, has become sort of like, you know, this horror, this specter. Everybody says we must not end up like Greece. And this has become this kind of mantra. So what you've lost a sense of solidarity of these countries among themselves, and everybody's a little bit out for themselves. And I find here in Italy, there is extremely little coverage of what's happening in Greece. My Italian colleagues always say, what are you going to Greece for? What's happening there? And there's no big news. The elections are over. So there's a sort of unwillingness to really confront what's going on. The same is true in Spain.
That is Silvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for NPR's Foreign Desk, and you can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondents. And Mark, what do you make of how the U.S. media are covering the crisis in Europe, specifically what you're just hearing from Silvia about what's happening on the ground in Greece, and how is McClatchy covering this?
Well, I'll have to confess, McClatchy, I think, is like a lot of U.S. media. We have not done in several months much reporting on the situation on the ground. And I think that's part of the reason for that is that the intense focus and concern about the financial impact of Europe on the United States has basically faded. And I think that's taken it out of the daily news coverage of most American news organizations. The story that she's telling is one that is a continuation of what's been happening in Greece in particular for a number of months, and it's gotten so bad. But I think most American organizations haven't looked at it. I know that our Istanbul Bureau, which has responsibility for Greece and Spain, has been so intensely focused on Syria the last few months that we have not revisited pieces we did about the problems of medical care in Greece, the problems of really of economic collapse in Spain as well. It's been months since we've looked at it.
Does this have to do with resources, or do outlets feel that there's not much interest because you have a very strong team of correspondents covering the economy.
Well,
we've had many reporters on the show.
Yeah, part of it is resources, and part of it is looking to what we think are issues that our readers will be intensely focused on, and those 10 in recent days or months have tended to be in sequestration, debt ceiling, those Washington-focused issues. And I think that's part of it. We were more intensely focused on it when it seemed like the European crisis was going to spread to the United States in ways that would affect people's 401ks, frankly. So part of it is a resource issue. Part of it is a perception of what is likely to affect an American audience now.
Sylvia, what are your thoughts on that?
No, I agree, absolutely. And, of course, it was a big story, particularly at the time of the election campaign in the United States, precisely if there were a big upheaval in the Eurozone, how it could affect also the campaign between Obama and Romney. But I agree, and I think it's very true that there was this sort of reaction that it was very much linked to the American perception of what it could happen. I'm afraid now that may start again, but not this time from Greece, but we have Italian elections coming up now, and there's a lot of concern here that it may end up, there may be a I won't go into all the details, but there may end up being a stalemate, similar situation to what happened in Greece last year, that they had to repeat the election a month later in May because there was basically a hung parliament and impossibility to create a government. And that may happen next month here in Italy. And that may revive a lot of concerns about the Eurozone. Already we see with the return, the success in the polls of former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, the markets are incredibly nervous. And European leaders are terrified of the possibility that Berlusconi could come back to power, which I think is absolutely impossible. But he could become a bit of a troublemaker and paralyze the situation politically. And so the markets are already reacting to that. We may see a return of American media interest in the whole Eurozone crisis in just a few weeks.
Well, and Mark, the argument that people make about why we need this kind of reporting is because there's so much austerity in Europe, and we're seeing austerity in the U.S. So a lot of people say, hey, we need to look to Europe to see what could possibly ultimately happen in the United States. What are your thoughts about that argument?
Well, I think readers and listeners all benefit from whatever information you can get them in terms of austerity or economic difficulties elsewhere. To be perfectly honest, I think the stories of impact of austerity inside the United States are dramatic in and of themselves, and are probably the ones that an American audience needs to hear about first. Because it's, we're looking at, especially as we're talking about across-the-board cuts on domestic programs, that's going to have a huge impact here.
Right.
I'm not sure that we face the same kinds of difficulty that people in Greece face, because some of our social network, anyway, is not directly affected by what's being proposed on sequestration. But there are very dramatic stories inside the United States as well. I think it won't be very many more weeks before people start looking at some of those stories. And, of course, when Sylvia does a piece, it raises people's awareness, not just of listeners, but of editors, too. And they say, okay, this is an interesting topic we haven't dealt with in several months. We should go back at it. But I do think, I think in general terms, any information that we give readers that discuss the difficulties that these kinds of economic changes create for real people, I think that's important for them to get.
That is Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondents. We're also joined by Sylvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for NPR's foreign desk. And we're talking about Media coverage of how austerity and budget cuts are actually affecting people on the ground. Sylvia's recent piece looks at how Greeks are really suffering from austerity. After a year after losing a job, a worker loses all health benefits. You can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. And what are your thoughts on this kind of reporting? How do you want the media to cover budget cuts and the connections with austerity that we see in Europe? And if you have any questions for Sylvia about the reporting that she's doing on the ground in Greece and Italy and Spain, we'd love to hear from you. And then later in the show, we'll be talking about media coverage of John Brennan's hearing, drones, and torture. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Sylvia, can you describe the process of, you know, pitching a story like this to NPR? Because we're getting so little of it in the United States, it's so important to hear the voices of people who are really suffering on the ground. So what is that process like?
Well, you know, I talk it with my editor. Sometimes a suggestion comes from my editor. Sometimes it's I pitch a story. It depends. I mean, I particularly wanted to go to cover exactly what this fraying of the society. That was I hadn't been there in a few months. I hadn't been back in Greece, and I wanted to go back to see exactly how much worse things were getting for average people on a day-to-day basis, and it was worse than I expected. But essentially, I think at NPR, I feel very fortunate that NPR has been very attentive to this whole Eurozone crisis from the beginning. And I've certainly been on it now. I mean, starting with, I think, 2009 in Greece and Spain, Portugal, and Italy. And I have to say, it's a difficult story. It's particularly, you know, it's challenging on the whole difficult, arcane economic aspect. But it's, of course, it's very, very compelling and very, very challenging, very sad to cover it on the ground, which I find is... right now, that's I find more important to tell the stories on the ground than the complicated economic ones.
Well, that's the complaint we hear sometimes, Mark, from people about the U.S. media, is that there's so much focus on the politics behind these economic decisions, and you rarely hear about what's happening on the ground and just, you know, real suffering and the consequences of the politics.
Well, I think actually for a journalist, it's more interesting to tell the story of the people and how they're affected, and it always surprises that our default position is to talk about the politics of it. I think in the terms of just, you know, why there might be less coverage now, is that editors are struggling with making that connection to the reader. I'm not sure you really need to affect a reader's life directly in telling a compelling story of, as Sylvia put it, the fraying of society. Everyone, I think, can identify with that and understand it and find it interesting. So I certainly, you know, would be sympathetic to criticisms that our default position is the politics and the economics. Sometimes that sort of reporting, what a lot of people call high-altitude reporting, fails to capture the actual gritty impact of some of these policies.
I just sort of like to add one thing that for another aspect that we haven't touched on is that what's happening also is, you've probably seen reports of this already in the elections last year, that the neo-Nazi party Golden Dawn, that hardly existed at all before, won a tremendous number of votes. I got some 7% as several MPs in parliament. And they are, you know, this economic crisis has so increased, has so polarized people. It's created so much tension, and how immigrants have become scapegoats of this thing. And now there's a lot of fear of two extremes developing, of political violence exploding on both sides of the political spectrum.
And hold that thought. We'll ask you to continue that right after a break. You're listening to Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. They're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about how copyright laws are affecting our access to information in the digital age. The suicide of activist Aaron Schwartz has brought these issues to the fore. He faced federal felony charges for allegedly downloading millions of articles from an archive of scholarly journals. So who should have access to academic research online? That's the conversation we'll have on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we are joined by Silvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for NPR's Foreign Desk. She has been covering the economic crisis in Europe for the last 3 years. Her latest pieces focus on the privatization of Greek assets and the effects of 3 years of austerity on Greek society. Mark Seibel oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondents. He joined the Bureau in 2003 as the editor in charge of international and national security coverage. And if you'd like to join us, Silvia will be on for just a few more minutes. So if you have any questions for her about the reporting she does in Europe, now would be a good time to call 866-798-8255. And then a little later in the show, we'll be talking about coverage of John Brennan's confirmation hearings. We'll talk about drones and torture. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So before the break, Silvia, you were talking about the rise of neo-Nazi parties, scapegoating immigrants, and then also the social tension that all of this is creating. And what are your thoughts on how this is being covered in the media?
Well, certainly this in Greece, I have to say, even though they have a rather difficult media situation with many papers have been shutting down. And there's a lot of ambiguity also about relations between some of the media owners and the government. Nevertheless, it certainly has been getting a lot of coverage. The Golden Dawn is a very worrisome development. I mean, extremely problematic. This is something that several Europeans now are very worried about. Already the Italian Prime Minister, Mr. Mario Monti, several months ago said one of the worst possible risks of this of the worsening Eurozone crisis is the rise of populism, nationalist movements, anti-immigrant neo-Nazis. He had actually proposed a European Union-wide conference to tackle the issue. I don't think that ever happened, though. Certainly in Greece, this is very worrisome. There was the killing of a Pakistani just a few weeks ago. Two members of Golden Dawn have been arrested as suspects. While I was there, there was a big demonstration by immigrants and many other Greeks against the neo-Nazi party. But it's at the same time, there have been now new other some violent acts by so-called anarchist groups that nobody had ever heard of before. These are smaller things, the little sort of pipe bombs in a shopping mall. Nobody's been hurt. But they're very worrisome signs. The government has used these latest pipe bombs as deciding to crack down. There have been raids against squatters, and this could just foment a lot of tension. It's already very tense, and this could get much much worse.
Mm. Well, go ahead, Mark.
Sylvia, am I right? Have the police actually turned over to Golden Dawn some of their enforcement responsibilities? That's something I've heard.
Technically, what has been shown is that very, very large numbers of members of the police force are voters of Golden Dawn. And we have a lot of anecdotal evidence that when Golden Dawn is active, when they're patrolling the streets, I've seen them at night in the center of Athens, sort of thuggy-looking guys, you know, and the streets are pretty empty. But we certainly know that the police have looked the other way when there have been a lot of harassment of immigrants, beating up of immigrants. There's definitely a lot of witnesses to that. It's been shown that they have a lot of support from the police. There's no question about that. There's a sympathy. There's an ideological sympathy.
And again, Golden Dawn is a neo-Nazi party in Greece.
Absolutely. And what is so strange is that there is really no neo-Nazi culture. There never has been. There was a military junta for several years in Greece in the late 60s, 70s, but it was more of a fascist bent. But the neo-Nazi movement has no roots in Greece. In fact, the Greeks were very forceful in their partisans fighting the Nazis when they occupied in Second World War. So it's very strange that this incredibly strong neo-Nazi movement has developed so suddenly and so powerfully. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's hear from a few listeners. Let's go to Winston in San Francisco. Hi, Winston. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm just calling to echo what Ms. Pajoli was saying about the effects of austerity. I lived in Italy for many years back in the 60s and 70s. And while I lived in Rome in the mid-70s, that was the first time I'd heard the expression austerità. And it was being introduced by the government to help cut back expenses and trim down budgets. And it had a terrible and immediate effect on just about everybody, from the dull to rich. And I likened it to the kind of treatment a doctor would give someone if they were ill, like, well, let's put a tourniquet around your leg. Now let's put a tourniquet around your arm. Now let's put a tourniquet around your neck. And by, this will help you save energy consuming food and air and other things. And by, you weaken and wither and die. And I don't really know what other effects you can expect from this kind of program, especially politically overall throughout Europe and country by country. It seems to usher in and also usher in other things such as like the Nazis, like in Germany and during the Depression in the 30s, and now in Greece and other places, even in Italy, the rise of the MSI would have been impossible when I lived there, but now they're back in charge with the...
All right, well, Winston, thank you so much for calling, and sorry to cut you off, but your line is not so great, but we'll get a comment in just a minute. First, let's go to Nick in Monterey. Hi, Nick, welcome to the show.
Hello, good afternoon. I want to make a comment in regard to the story of the measures. I actually came from the area from the former Yugoslavia. And kind of everything I see about the Greece, it kind of in a way resembles those days where first came the austerity measures, and within a year, the country was already in some sort of turmoil economic, which sort of become the political and ethnic war eventually. And I can see the tensions rising. So my worry is certainly that actually by implementing austerity measures, the country gets ravaged to that point that actually it's easy to push it in any given direction. And I'm thinking that actually Greek are going to get pushed into some conflict against Turkey or so for whatever reason it is, because they've reached the point where they cannot actually continue in the same direction without... without a major disaster, actually. Mm. And, by completely stripping population from any dignity and from any source of income, everybody becomes easy target for whatever, general idea becomes, and it could be actually absolutely wrong, and it can be actually exploited to great extent by the other powers or whatever,
Right.
I can see.
Well, Nick, thank you for calling in. And Sylvia, what's your response?
Well, it's not totally implausible. I heard some analysts also in Athens said, got to be very careful that somebody doesn't even think of maybe using an incident, creating an incident with Turkey as a distraction. Some people suggest that these police raids on the anarchists, on the squatters, you have to understand this, one of the houses that was raided and the anarchists were kicked out had been occupied for 25 years. Mm. I mean, it's not exactly, it was on university grounds also, and it had, the university had allowed them to stay there for 25 years. So all of a sudden this raid was perceived as a, you know, by some analysts as a, you know, a way for the government to distract from the economics. Right? You create a political so-called emergency as a way to distract from people's economic problems. A diplomatic incident or something like that over some rock in the Aegean Sea with Turkey is not completely far-fetched.
Well, there's clearly a lot of interest in this, Sylvia, and at least here among our listening audience. So we definitely should do a show about austerity in Greece, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
That.
Thank you. And thanks for your reporting.
Okay.
That's Sylvia Poggioli. She is senior European correspondent for NPR's Foreign Desk, covering political, economic, and cultural news in Italy, the Vatican, Western Europe, and the Balkans. And she joined us from Rome. You can find her pieces about how austerity is affecting average people on the streets. It's really amazing to hear that in some places we're talking about a 90% unemployment rate. She also has a piece about the privatization of everything from beaches to ports, you name it. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. And this is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's our media roundtable. And joining us for the rest of the hour is Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondents. He was assigned to Knight Ridder's Washington Bureau to coordinate reporters during both the Gulf War in 91 and the March 2003 invasion of Iraq. So, Mark, let's start talking now about media coverage of yesterday's hearing of John Brennan, President Obama's CIA nominee, and drones and torture. As I said in the intro, before this hearing, we were told by every outlet from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution to MSNBC to USA Today, you name it, that we were going to get tough questions for Brennan. What did you think of the questions that were asked yesterday by the Senate Intelligence Committee?
I think we did get some tough questions, some pointed questions at least. But what surprised me about it was not that they were directed at drones and torture, but the range of the anger, frustration, disappointment, whatever word you want to apply to it, of issues that the senators reflected in their questioning. You had questions about CIA memorandum going back to the run-up to the Iraq War. Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan, very pointedly waived a redacted memorandum, apparently about Czechoslovakia, and whether, or the Czech Republic, I guess, at that time, and whether there had been a meeting between Mohammed Atta, who was one of the 9/11 hijackers, and some representative of Saddam Hussein in Prague. And you might remember that at the time, that was one of the things that the Bush administration had used to sort of rally enthusiasm for invading Iraq in 2003. And, of course, Levin's point was it's untrue, and yet you won't release the memo, publicize the memo that says it's untrue. And I was taken by how many times old disputes got aired at that hearing yesterday, not just the drone program, not just whether Brennan should have known there was a torture program that the CIA was running. And I came away thinking of it, these are issues that we have never resolved as a nation.
Hmm.
We've never gotten to the bottom line of what happened with Iraq weapons of mass destruction. We've never gotten really solid information about what happened to prisoners that we had taken and put in CIA's black sites. We don't know where those black sites were. We've never really gotten a decent answer, and I thought Brennan's answer on this question was particularly interesting, on whether any of the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques or torture for lots of people that were used on prisoners in the CIA custody, whether any of that led to the information that ultimately led to the killing of bin Laden in May of 2011. There's Brennan. He's asked that question. Do you believe that those enhanced interrogation techniques led to useful information? And he obviously, at some point, had testified somewhere, because Saxby Chambliss talked about it, that they had. And yet now he wants to say that they didn't. And he says, finally, you know, I don't know anymore. I've read the Senate Intelligence Committee had done a 6,000-page report on this, which has not been made public yet. He'd read some portion of that report, and it left him with doubts that everything he had been told about the CIA interrogation program left him with doubts about whether it was true. Well, you know, if you have a senior CIA official who now can no longer say what he believes is the truth of that program, then we're in a difficult position as a country, and it's because we've never been willing to confront these issues. The current administration has wanted to leave that behind. That's in the past. Let's move forward. We've heard the president say that, and yet you could see in that hearing yesterday that these senators, both Republicans and Democrats, were troubled by the fact we still have no public determination of what took place and what was true.
Why is that, and what role does the media play in bringing out these issues and important questions?
Well, I think the problem from a media perspective, and I use this, you know, in the grand scheme, not any individual news outlet, because I think McClatchy has done some reporting on this. The New York Times certainly has pursued some reporting on this. I mean, I think it's done, but as a especially when you get to the electronic media, it is not pursued in a regular way, and we have short attention spans, and we move on. We aren't going to get a solution or an answer to our questions about what took place in the CIA black sites, and gosh, it's been 10 years ago, and do people even care anymore? But in fact, you know, what took place there is something, whether it's driving the debate now, it's something that ought to be resolved. We ought to know what the truth was. We ought to know, so we aren't guessing by watching 30 dark, Zero Dark 30 about whether torture actually produced information that led to bin Laden. And you know, that's been the hot debate for the last couple of months, and I guess will be certainly debated through the Oscars anyway. But you can see that we don't know the answer to that, and Brennan didn't know the answer to it. And here is a man who is going to run the Central Intelligence Agency and was in a senior position at the time to know what was going on. And he just bluntly says, I don't know the answer to that.
That is Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondence. And we'd love to hear from you on this. This has been getting extensive coverage this week. The hearings were yesterday. So today the media are offering their analysis. What are your thoughts about what Mark raises that we really haven't had serious conversations about so many things that have happened over the past, 12 years now? What are your thoughts on how this is being covered? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. I want to ask you, Mark, about a column we just ran across by Neil McDonald. He's a senior Washington correspondent for the CBC, and the piece is called U.S. Media Complicit in Obama's Drone Doctrine. He said we got in touch with him, but I guess the reporters aren't allowed to comment on their own column, so he couldn't join us. But I just want to read you part of his comment or column, and I'd love you to comment. He writes, in 2001, when Israel started killing Palestinians and often innocent bystanders with missiles fired from helicopters hovering so high you could barely see them, foreign reporters were urged by the Israeli government to call the practice, quote, targeted killing. Most of us, including many of my American colleagues, preferred the term extrajudicial assassination. We felt we were in the news business, not the euphemism business. Today, 12 years later, The Washington Post carries a front page headline about the U.S. drone program titled Targeted Killings Face New Scrutiny. So his point is that now most in the media are calling these killings targeted killings. What are your thoughts on that? And
well,
his overall argument about the U.S. media being complicit in this.
What I would say, if you want to talk about complicity, I think it's generally that the news media has not challenged enough the version of events that we get from the White House on what's actually taken place. Now, part of that is that we're not in a very good position to examine what's taken place in a drone strike. It's usually someplace that either we can't or would be very difficult or very dangerous to get to. And so there's no independent assessment. And I think that's one of the things that you also saw in the Brennan hearing and the discussion of the Office of Legal Counsel memo. That's the Justice Department organization that gives the White House legal guidance and their justification for why the drone program is legal. I think we're complicit in that we, when we don't have information, we tend to opt to repeat what the official sources tell us and aren't very challenging about it. I don't know whether targeted killing is such a great euphemism. It sounds pretty specific and deadly to me. I don't know whether it's... I do think, it is extrajudicial. Clearly, there is no judicial process involved in it. And that's one of the things that I think the Brennan nomination has brought out into the open. Really, it is the decision of the executive branch who should be targeted and whether they are correctly targeted. And the white paper that was released earlier on Monday, this was sort of a summation of the Justice Department memos, basically says there can be no judicial review of this because it's done in wartime and the decisions have to be made very quickly and a court cannot be involved in it. So it's, I think complicity is a huge word, but I would say that in general, the U.S. news media has not been very good at examining the rationale behind it, exploring the program, even trying to track down who's been killed and who hasn't been killed in these things. It's not the only place. I think Guantanamo is a place that most American news organizations don't cover. And yet it certainly is an exception in two centuries of American jurisprudence. And deserves more attention. And part of that is, the 9/11 fear and fever that actually probably led us into a war in Iraq without a lot of discussion of open discussion of what we really knew about what was going on in Iraq.
What do you think also about U.S. media outlets that reveal that they complied with the Obama administration's request to hide the location of a U.S. drone base in Saudi Arabia, which was first used in 2011 to kill Anwar al-Awlaki. He's a U.S. citizen. The Washington Post is reporting that, according to a reporter on the National Security Beat, the New York Times participated in what they're calling an informal agreement to keep secret this base for U.S. interests, and then suddenly withdrew from that arrangement. Also in the Post, this is kind of interesting. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Quote, the Post learned Tuesday night that another news organization was planning to reveal the location of the base, effectively ending an informal agreement among several news organizations that had been aware of the location for more than a year.
Well, of course, that's one of those things I always am amazed, and McClatchy actually has a policy to not withhold information we know, in that we think we ought to publish what we know. That's what we do. I'm not quite certain why the Washington Post and the New York Times felt it was important to comply with the idea that of withholding the location in Saudi Arabia. That was probably intended more to save the Saudis from embarrassment for hosting a U.S. base than it was any actual threat to that base. I'm sure that's the argument that was made to the news organizations. You know, I think it's interesting that obviously at some point, and the sequence of events here is that the New York Times published a very interesting piece on the drone warfare in Yemen, in which they decided to repeat that fact. I don't know why they decided now was any less risky than a year ago to release that fact. Obviously, if the Washington Post had felt very strongly that that fact was important to be withheld, whatever the New York Times did, they would not have then broken their own resolve to keep it secret. So I think, you know, what you see is that there's a lot of that protecting of classified information at the request of the government that is really unnecessary and is probably more about keeping sources happy than it really is about any sort of national security issue.
And just briefly, we only have a minute left, but how do you also deal with leaked information? Because in the same column by Neil McDonald, it says even several news outlets have noted that the administration seems expert at leaking classified material that makes the government look good. How does McClatchy deal with this kind of leaked information?
Well, if we get a leak, you know, we used to have an editor who said you don't print it just because somebody tells you. Any leaked information we get, we try to verify. We try to figure out what the spin is that they're trying to use us to distribute and what the actual value of the information is. So that I think every leak we get, we weigh the same way, which is what is its news value? What's the truth of it? Why have we been given the information? And is it being pitched to us in a way that accurately reflects events, or is it being pitched to us to hide an actual event? We tend to like to verify everything on the ground.
And before we end, Mark, what are you working on right now?
Well, I think what we're working on right now is going back over everything that came up at the hearing yesterday and exploring what the basis was for it. We had a very interesting piece back in 2009 that Jonathan Landay, who's our chief national security correspondent, wrote, and he covered the hearing yesterday too. And he was quite taken with Carl Levin's discussion of that check memo.
All right, Mark, thank you so much. We'll check out that piece and put it on our website. Mark Seibel oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondents. Thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on. How is copyright law affecting our access to information in the digital age? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the changing landscape of copyright law and the Internet. The suicide of activist Aaron Swartz has brought this issue to the fore. He faced federal felony charges for allegedly downloading millions of articles from an archive of scholarly journals. Who should have access to academic research online? And how do you think intellectual property should be shared or regulated? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listener of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.